Good morning. It's time again for the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader Chuck Kaufman in Flagstaff, bringing you these headlines from the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Shutdown deadline, Ukraine weigh on Trump's fall agenda, stocks in U.S. stand at their priciest, and American businesses find one tariff list to embrace. Our first headline, Shutdown Deadline, Ukraine Weigh on Trump's Fall Agenda, is by Natalie Andrews and Gavin Bade. President Congress faced the need to reach agreement on spending before October the 1st. Washington. President Trump faces a challenging September at home and abroad. An end-of-month deadline will force the president to negotiate with Congress to avoid a government shutdown. While Republicans control the House and Senate, they will need Democrat votes. Trump's recent clawback of billions of dollars in foreign aid without congressional approval has brewed distrust between lawmakers and the administration. Trump gave the leaders of Russia and Ukraine another deadline to move forward with the peace process, this one early in September, or face possible U.S. retaliation. Progress has stalled since the president's much-watched meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Alaska in August, dimming optimism that an end to the war is in sight. Beyond deal-making, Trump, a Republican, faces uncertainty about the legality of his tariffs, the main plank of his economic agenda. His authority to take over Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C. expires this month, and he's looking at deploying the National Guard to more cities across the country in what he says is an effort to address crime. The administration's contentious changes to public health guidelines are expected to face fresh scrutiny in the coming weeks. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on Thursday is scheduled to testify before the Senate Finance Committee after the abrupt firing of the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which unleashed turmoil inside the agency. Kennedy's much-anticipated report on implementing what he calls his Make America Healthy Again agenda, which he said would outline the alleged causes of autism, is expected soon. Congress returns to the Capitol on Tuesday after more than a month away, and lawmakers must immediately begin negotiations on a spending deal to avoid a government shutdown at the end of the month. This one's going to be a sheer face rock climb to get to the top with not much equipment, said Ron Bongean, a Republican strategist and partner at ROKK Solutions, who said a shutdown is more likely this year than a spending deal. Negotiations between the two parties are likely to be more complicated than usual. Trump last week irked members of both parties by canceling nearly $5 billion in foreign aid through a maneuver called a pocket rescission that comes so close to the end of the fiscal year that the money won't be spent. Senator Susan Collins of Maine, the top Republican on the Appropriations Committee, called the move a clear violation of the law. Similarly, some Democrats have warned that a shutdown could happen over concerns that the White House, by using rescissions, isn't respecting either Congress's constitutionally mandated power of the purse or the bipartisan deals through which Congress exerts that power. A shutdown would result in the pause of pay for hundreds of thousands of government employees and delays in the services they perform, as only employees deemed essential are instructed to come to work. While Republican lawmakers loathe the stopgap spending bill, they most likely will need to make a deal on a short-term bill to make the October 1st deadline, which also requires Democrat votes. Operating through a stopgap measure, however, makes it easier for the Trump administration to pull back funds since it isn't bound by a set of detailed instructions that accompany ordinary appropriations bills. The return of lawmakers to Washington will also reignite the fight over the Jeffrey Epstein files. The Justice Department has turned over files to the House Oversight Committee, but lawmakers are pushing for a vote to release them publicly. Representatives Ro Khanna, Democrat of California, and Thomas Massie, Republican of Kentucky, are opening a petition for signatures this week that could force a House vote to release files on the convicted sex offender. The president's emergency takeover of the Washington, D.C. police force will expire September 10th. To continue further, the House and Senate would need to pass a joint resolution authorizing an extension. There are no time constraints on how long Trump can use the National Guard and federal law enforcement in the city. Trump has discussed sending troops elsewhere into the country, such as Baltimore and Chicago. On Friday, Trump will face his first jobs report since firing the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics in August. He has since picked E.J. Antoni, the chief economist at the Conservative Heritage Foundation, to lead the agency, though Antoni may have to wade through a long list of nominees waiting for confirmation votes in the Senate. To hasten the process, Senate Republicans have signaled support to change the rules. Trump has pushed for Russia and Ukraine to reach a peace agreement and, in late August, gave Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky another two-week deadline to take steps toward resolving the war between their countries. Efforts at talks between Kyiv and Moscow have stalled. Putin on Monday met with leaders of China and India in a display of unity that was aimed in part to show their strength against Trump. Trump has ramped up tariffs on goods made in India as he seeks to punish the country for using Russian oil. India has stood firm. It is unclear what Trump will do to spur negotiations to end the Ukraine war. Trump has resisted implementing new sanctions on Russia. Beyond September, Trump will face a fresh hurdle on his implementation of tariffs, one of his key focuses as president that he's used to boost manufacturing in the U.S. as well as reduce the deficit. A federal appeals court ruled late Friday that most of Trump's tariffs, the so-called reciprocal levies, are illegal but left them in place until October 14th to allow the administration time to appeal. That sets up a high-stakes battle at the Supreme Court that will define not only the future of Trump's trade agenda, but also his broader efforts to expand the executive power of the presidency. The High Court is highly likely to take up the case, said Ryan Majoris, a partner in trade law at King & Spalding, which will force them to grapple with whether Trump can use presidential emergency powers to impose global tariffs. The Supreme Court could hear arguments as soon as this fall in the case, Majoris added, though a resolution isn't likely before the end of the year. At the same time, congressional Democrats are planning to put more pressure on Trump's trade agenda by forcing votes on proposals to end the emergency authority that is at the core of the tariff case. The legal uncertainty surrounding the tariffs could also bleed over into negotiations with other countries on how to codify trade agreements they previously reached with Trump or strike new pacts to mutually lower duties. Trump's team over the weekend insisted they are staying the course. And that's shutdown deadline, Ukraine way on Trump's fall agenda. Next, we have an article by Jack Pitcher. Stocks in U.S. stand at their priciest. The S&P 500 has never been this expensive or more centered on fewer companies. The S&P 500's march to a record this year hasn't come cheap. By some measure, stocks have never been pricier. Investors are now paying more than ever for each dollar of revenue the index's members produce. The benchmark traded at 3.23 times sales on Thursday. A record. Price-to-earnings ratios aren't quite at records, thanks to juicy profit margins at many of the index's most valuable companies, but they still sit at the extreme end of history. The S&P 500 currently trades at 22.5 times its projected earnings over the next 12 months, compared with the average of 16.8 times since 2000. Many investors say the biggest U.S. stocks, most of which are technology companies, are worth every penny. Companies such as Nvidia and Microsoft are still boosting sales and profits at rapid pace, and they have come to dominate the market. The 10 largest companies in the S&P 500 accounted for 39.5% of its total value at the end of July, the most ever, according to Morningstar. Nine have a market capitalization above $1 trillion. I'm not so worried about that in and of itself, said Steve Sosnick, chief strategist at Interactive Brokers. The big question is, what can happen if the situation changes? Investors caught a glimpse of the downside of the market's concentration in a handful of expensive stocks in April when President Trump's tariff plans triggered a brief sell-off. The so-called Magnificent Seven tech stocks performed worse than the full S&P 500, which underperformed the same group of 500 stocks if each member were weighted equally. The combination of very high valuations and very crowded trades certainly raises the susceptibility of the market to an extended downturn, Sosnick added. If everyone is effectively long the same things, where do the marginal buyers come from when they fall? Not everything looks expensive. In fact, the average company in the S&P 500 isn't trading at staggering prices. If every company in the S&P 500 were weighted equally rather than by market value, the index would be trading at 1.76 times sales compared with its long-term average of 1.43. Mark Giambroni, head of U.S. equities at value-focused Barrow Hanley Global Investors, said he's seeing plenty of attractive opportunities for investors willing to look beyond mega-cap tech. Parts are even below average to some degree, Giambroni said. His firm is favoring businesses that might be able to benefit from artificial intelligence in terms of increased productivity, but don't yet come with AI company valuations. He's skeptical that the biggest companies can maintain current valuations long term. At one point or another, valuations tend to matter, and the expectations baked into those valuations matter, and those expectations are getting to be so dramatic it will be very hard to meet them, Giambroni said. Stocks in U.S. stand at their priciest. Our next article, American Businesses Find One Tariff List to Embrace. This is by Ruth Simon. Greg Owens, chairman of Sherrill Manufacturing, was at home skimming through emails on a recent Friday when he got a text message that made him stand up from his chair and raise his arms in triumph. As co-founder of Sherrill, which bills itself as America's last manufacturer of stainless steel flatware, Owens had been fighting for years to keep his business afloat in a market flooded with cheaper imports. Now he felt like Sherrill stood a fighting chance. The text in question said imported stainless steel flatware products would be hit with 50% tariffs on their steel content. This was the news for which Owens had been waiting. "It's a moment of wow," Owens said. "It's been so much work and so long to get some of these victories. The Trump administration's tariff policies are creating headaches, uncertainty, and extra costs for scores of U.S. companies, from automakers to clothing importers. But for some companies that rely on American manufacturing, like Sherrill, this new era of tariffs could give them a shot in the arm." On the list released by the Commerce Department, more than 400 items imported to the U.S. would be hit with tariffs on their steel and aluminum content, from farm equipment, bulldozers, and industrial robots to dumbbells, infant swings, and infant walkers. Unlike the so-called reciprocal tariffs that Trump announced in April, these tariffs are imposed under a national security rationale. The reciprocal tariffs have been challenged in court. The sector-specific tariffs, by contrast, are imposed under a separate legal authority that is far more established and durable, Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962. Trump has said he's planning to expand the list of goods. Now, some small businesses are pushing to get protectionist tariffs applied to more products. One such company is Golden's Foundry and Machine, based in Columbus, Georgia, founded in 1882. Golden's started out making syrup kettles and sugarcane mills. These days, it produces metal castings used mostly in trucking, material handling, and construction, as well as a handful of consumer products like kettlebells and dumbbells, cast iron fire pits, and Kamado grills. It has 175 employees. "As the tariff conversion has moved forward, we find ourselves in an awkward sort of ignored place," said George Boyd Jr., the company's fifth-generation chief executive. "The steel tariff is good for steel mills, but we're a jobbing foundry, and that's pouring iron." Jobbing foundries produce customized parts, often for a range of buyers. Boyd says companies like his play a key role in manufacturing, but they're often overlooked because they make components instead of finished products. Boyd decided to petition the Commerce Department to include dumbbells and kettlebells on the list, hoping that it would help ensure the industry's viability. He was successful and now is looking to petition for more of his products to be included. What we have now is essentially companies asking for more things to be tariffed, said Jason Miller, a professor of supply chain management at Michigan State University. He estimates that the list of more than 400 goods announced in August adds tariffs to about $164 billion of imported goods. Scott Lincecum, a vice president with the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank, says many of the products added to the list have no connection to national security, the ostensible purpose for the additional levies. There is certainly an open sign on the tariff buffet, Lincecum said. Like a buffet, it's pretty easy to get your fill. Owens flatware business, Cheryl, gets about 60% of revenue from consumers who buy the company's Liberty Tabletop brand online. The Central New York factory was once the world's largest flatware maker, with 2,300 employees turning out 3.4 million pieces of cutlery each week in the 1990s. The company's co-founders, Owens and Matthew Roberts, struck a deal in 2005 to buy the factory buildings and other assets for $1 million from Oneida Limited in a transaction that included a five-year production and warehousing contract. They rehired 120 employees. But the journey has been hard. After the financial crisis, they went through bankruptcy, and more recently, the company hasn't been able to produce flatware at a price that could get it a place on store shelves. We couldn't compete with the Chinese factory, said Owens. We couldn't even come up with a price mainstream retailers could accept. Now, with imports getting slapped with a tariff, Owens is optimistic. He's also hopeful that his business could benefit from the elimination of the de minimis rule, which allowed packages worth $800 or less to come in tariff-free. He's already seen an increase in inquiries this year from hospitality and other institutional customers, and even a handful of retailers. None have resulted yet in new purchase orders, but the company has brought on a handful of extra workers in response to higher online sales. It's been a stellar moment, said Owens. This provides us with an opportunity to grow going forward. And that was American Businesses Find One Tariff List to Embrace. Next article, Planned AI Centers Strain Energy Grid. Electricity prices across the U.S. have increased 5.5% in the past year. This article is by Jennifer Hiller. Data centers are desperate to connect to the U.S. electric grid. What remains fuzzy is how many will ultimately be built and how much electricity they will require. U.S. utilities are reporting a sharp upswing in interconnection requests from prospective data centers that will need an extraordinary amount of electricity to power America's artificial intelligence race. In some cases, the collective requests equal or surpass by multiples the existing electricity demand in a utility's entire service region. Take America Electric Power, a big utility that serves 11 states, and Sempra's Texas utility, Oncor. Combined, they have received requests to connect projects, many of them data centers, to the grid, requiring almost 400 gigawatts of electricity. That is an astronomical amount that represents more than half the peak electricity demand in the lower 48 states on two hot days in July. Part of the problem is the electricity needs of the same potential projects are being double, triple, or quadruple counted by different utilities. Data center developers and tech companies are peppering utilities around the country with requests for service while scouting locations where they can quickly construct massive data centers and connect to the grid. A lot of it is real, but how much? Asked Tom Falcone, president of the Large Public Power Council, a trade association for the nation's largest not-for-profit electric utilities. Utilities will see a massive opportunity in AI, but realize that many proposed projects will never be built, earning them the moniker Phantom Data Centers. Utilities don't want to run the risk of building too many power plants or transmission lines if the AI hype is overblown or the tech industry doesn't ultimately need as much electricity as projected. Other customers would get stuck with the infrastructure costs. Electricity prices across the country have increased 5.5% in the past year, outpacing inflation, according to Labor Department data. U.S. electricity demand was flat for two decades until around 2020, but is now rising across the country, growing about 2% a year nationally, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. The AI frenzy is largely responsible. A search on a generative AI platform like ChatGPT can use at least 10 times the amount of energy as a Google search. Demand is rising at an even faster pace in places like Northern Virginia and Texas with large data centers and factory growth. In Texas, Oncor had 552 requests from large customers such as data centers or industrial facilities in its interconnection queue by the end of June. That's up 30% from the end of March. Its current system peak, or the power consumption at the moment customers require the most electricity, is 31 gigawatts. The requests in the queue from data centers require about 186 gigawatts, while industrial firms have requested about 19 gigawatts. The transmission and distribution utility serves a swath of the Dallas-Fort Worth area, a major market for data centers, and much of the West Texas oil field where companies have been electrifying operations. Historically, the average data center interconnection request at Oncor required less than 100 megawatts of electricity. That's now closer to 700 megawatts, with some facilities requiring more, said Jeff Bailey, Oncor's vice president of corporate strategy. American Electric Power, meanwhile, has a 37-gigawatt system. Already, new customers requiring about 24 gigawatts of electricity have signed agreements to receive service by the end of the decade. That growth is equivalent to serving at least 6 million new homes. AEP executives have called it transformational. But AEP has an additional 190 gigawatts of potential demand in line, roughly five times its current system size and the equivalent power use of at least 48 million homes. We know not all of that is going to come online, but even a fraction of that is significant, Trevor Mihalik, AEP's chief financial officer, told analysts on the company's recent earnings call. CenterPoint Energy, the utility serving the Houston area, has seen a huge spike in interest from data centers despite criticism about its storm response. Hurricane Beryl last year knocked out power to much of the area because of downed trees and neighborhoods, but CenterPoint's high-voltage transmission system, the part of the grid of key interest to data center developers, was unscathed. What we saw with Hurricane Beryl was that we had no direct outages related to the transmission system and our substations, which is what feeds these data centers, Chief Executive Officer Jason Wells said. And so the data center community, ironically, felt more comfortable pursuing investment here, and our interconnection timelines are some of the fastest in the country. Electricity use on CenterPoint's Houston area system is currently a little more than 22 gigawatts, one of the highest for a U.S. metro area because of the combination of its industrial base, medical center, and population. It has interconnection requests for about 53 gigawatts of power, roughly 25 gigawatts of which are from data centers. A year ago, data centers were seeking just 1 gigawatt of power, said Wells, who estimated about 20% of the requested power will ultimately be delivered. Utilities across the country are giving similar odds to data center prospects. The developers are typically considering several possible construction sites because grid connections can take years and they can run into unpredictable roadblocks with permits or zoning. These hyperscalers and data center developers are themselves trying to figure out where they have a more streamlined path to market, said Ashkat Kaslewal, managing consultant at PA Consulting. There's just so much uncertainty around how long it will take for them to be able to energize and interconnect. That article, Planned AI Centers Strain Energy Grid. Let's turn to the opinion page of the Wall Street Journal for this item from the editorial staff of the Wall Street Journal. Gretchen Whitmer's big election stall. After delaying more than 235 days to call a special election for a vacant state Senate seat, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer on Friday declared a vote to fill it in May 2026. We have a lot of good work to get done before the end of the year, Ms. Whitmer said, adding that she looks forward to working with the next state senator from this district. Is Ms. Whitmer capable of embarrassment? Democrats control the Senate by a single vote, 19 to 18, and the governor clearly wants to stall on giving Republicans a chance to win the 35th district, which is a swing seat. But Michiganders have plenty of good work to do before mid-2026. Last week, the Republican-held state House passed a budget that's about $5 billion smaller than the Senate's version. Residents of the 35th district won't have a voice in the debate on reconciling the two bills, and they will now go unrepresented in the Senate for 16 months. In the past, Ms. Whitmer called special elections to fill vacancies in a matter of weeks. Ms. Whitmer's timeline will also be a headache for residents and election officials because the vacant Senate term expires at the end of next year. In other words, the victor of the May special election will win a short stint and then have to campaign again next November to stay in office. That means two primaries and two general elections in 9 months. While Democrats preach about democracy and how Republicans are threatening it, Ms. Whitmer has sought to squeeze out a partisan advantage by denying some 265,000 Michigan voters a voice in the state Senate because governor doesn't trust them to pick her party. Have liberal pundits and national Democrat leaders rushed to the MSNBC cameras to denounce this scheme? Ms. Whitmer isn't running for re-election, but Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist wants her job, and the state is closely divided. Democrats could still pay a price at the polls for voter frustration that they denied the 35th district a voice in this partisan power play. That's Gretchen Whitmer's big election stall. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. You can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming streaming on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org. Additionally, Sun Sounds programming is available on the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, and you can get that at the Apple App Store for your iPad or iPhone, or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And you can also listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot or Echo. Well, we'll turn now to business and finance in the Wall Street Journal, and we have these headlines. EV deals boom before deadline. Nestle fires CEO over relationship with direct report. And private equity strategy of Yale is harder to copy. We have that first article, EV deals boom before deadline. As tax credits expire, hotspots like Colorado have seen explosion of sales. This article is by Ryan Felton, Denver. At a Kia dealership on Denver's south side, a steady stream of shoppers navigate around noisy renovation work in search of electric vehicles with super cheap lease deals. How cheap? As of last week, Emek Kia offered to lease the small Niro EV for $40 a month before taxes. The EV6 lease was being marketed for less than $100 a month, while a $65,000 three-row EV9 could be had for $189 a month before taxes. Colt Emek, the store's general manager and a fourth-generation car salesman whose last name adorns dealerships around this region, said his family long had a rule of thumb. If a monthly lease payment is as little as 1% of the sticker price, that deal was as good as it gets for consumers. These EVs have just absolutely crushed that, Emek said. It's a small portion of a percentage. It's just unprecedented. Outside his office, 80-year-old John McCabe was about to take a red EV6 for a test drive. The retired physician is a longtime EV owner, most recently owning a Nissan Leaf, which he recharges through his solar-powered home. "We were going to buy one anyway," McCabe said. "As long as we're going to do it, you might as well get it done before the incentives disappear." The final days of the $7,500 federal tax credit for electric vehicle purchases, which expires September 30th, have set off a frenzied last-ditch car-buying spree, with buyers like McCabe and others trying to get an EV at a steep discount before it's too late. The deal bonanza marks the end of an era in the U.S. auto industry. After years of pushing electric cars to customers, automakers are ready for a world without the federal government's hefty incentive to support EV adoption or fuel efficiency rules that reward EV sales. That change will have ramifications around the country, with dealers who leaned heavily into electrification having to adjust on the fly and automakers pulling back on EV production. General Motors laid off about 360 employees at a plant in Detroit for at least a month to reduce production of the GMC Hummer EV and battery-powered Cadillac Escalade IQ. GM said it regularly updates schedules to align production with inventory needs. For now, dealers are preparing for an electrifying sales month, especially in Colorado, where EVs sell more briskly than in other states. Case in point, one of the top-selling vehicles in the Rocky Mountain State recently has been the all-electric Nissan Ariya Sport Utility Vehicle. "It's just been absolutely unbelievable for our sales volume," said Marcus Cam, director of sales at Tynan's Nissan, which has a $169 a month lease offer for a higher-end Ariya with a $57,000 sticker price. The SUV has been Tynan's top seller in 2025, and Nissan dealers in Colorado have accounted for one out of every three Arias sold in the U.S. since the start of 2025. Nissan has been emphasizing proactive advertising and getting Arias to dealers in markets like Colorado to meet demand, said spokesman Brian Brockman. The low-cost lease deals are allowing many first-time buyers to get an EV that they otherwise couldn't financially take on. That includes Paul Ibarra, a 39-year-old bus driver. Last week, Ibarra was on the Tynan's lot closely inspecting an Ariya he hoped to take home. Ibarra said he wanted to get an EV for a long time, primarily for environmental reasons, but the cost has been prohibitive. "There's no way I'd be able to afford this car if it weren't for the EV credits," he said. For years, Colorado has been a hotspot for electric cars. EVs made up almost one in five vehicles sold in the state from April through June, more than double the nationwide market share. EV specialists such as Tesla and Rivian have long reaped high sales from Colorado residents. In June, only Ford's F-Series pickups had a higher number of new vehicle registrations in the state than Tesla's Model Y, according to data from S&P Global Mobility. Dealers and officials here say that state incentive programs and a concerted effort to build out fast-charging infrastructure to allay range anxiety concerns have been the biggest drivers of EV adoption. But after September, dealers who've leaned heavily into selling EVs will have to adjust quickly to a world without financial help from the federal government. "The tax credits were not meant to be ongoing forever," Colorado Governor Jared Polis said in an interview. "They're meant to accelerate adoption of new technology, and they have done that." One hang-up dealers around the U.S. say is making sure EVs are sold off before the credit expires at the end of this month. The federal government has said that the credit could be applied to vehicles that have a firm contract with a significant down payment before then. So far, they're making progress selling down inventory, according to industry data from research firm J.D. Power. Greg Skolnick doesn't want to wait. The 55-year-old has been shopping around for a new EV to take advantage of the $7,500 federal credit before it ends. Last Wednesday, Skolnick was looking at a Volkswagen ID.4 SUV at a dealership offering a lease for as low as $39 a month before taxes. "That's a major driver," Skolnick said of the price. Dealers sound exasperated when asked if this is the best the market will ever be for EV buyers. "Yes," said Cam, the Nissan sales manager. "We may never see this level of deal again. And that's EV deals boom before deadline. Our next article is by Alexander Saidi and Mario Oru. Nestle fires CEO over relationship with direct report. Nestle said it dismissed chief executive Laurent Freixe with immediate effect following an investigation into an undisclosed romantic relationship with a direct subordinate that breached the group's code of conduct. The Swiss maker of Nescafe coffee and Purina pet food said Monday that its board had ordered a probe overseen by Chairman Paul Bulcke and lead independent director Pablo Isla with the support of independent outside counsel. This was a necessary decision, Bulcke said. Nestle's values and governance are strong foundations of our company, and I thank Laurent for his years of service at Nestle. Nestle didn't identify the employee in the relationship with Freixe. No one from the executive board had such a relationship with him, said a person familiar with the situation. Freixe didn't respond to a request for comment. His dismissal is the latest dramatic shift in the top echelons of Nestle in a little more than a year. In 2024, Nestle appointed Freixe to replace longtime CEO Mark Schneider last year in a bid to revive growth as the company grappled with sluggish sales. Schneider, the first outsider to run Nestle since 1922, was dismissed because he wasn't seen by its board as a good cultural fit, the Wall Street Journal previously reported. Freixe took the helm of the company in September 2024. Freixe, an industry veteran who joined Nestle in 1986, sought to reinvigorate sales growth at the world's largest packaged food maker, which makes everything from Nestle Toll House chocolate chips to DiGiorno pizza. In July, the company said it was launching a review of underperforming brands in its vitamins, minerals, and supplements unit that might result in a sale as it seeks to steer the business toward higher-end products such as Garden of Life and Solgar. Nestle reported organic sales growth of 3% for the second quarter. Now, the group said Philip Navratil, CEO of Nestle Nespresso, would succeed Freixe in the top job. Nestle's board had considered Navratil to be a potential successor to Freixe and decided to elevate him following the probe into the alleged misconduct, a person familiar with the matter said. Navratil's career with Nestle dates to 2001 when he was an internal auditor. Before running Nespresso, he had run Nestle's main coffee business globally. And that's Nestle fires CEO over relationship with direct report. Our next headline, private equity strategy of Yale is harder to copy. Swensen's success was fueled in part by 40 years of low interest rates. It's by Heather Gillers. Universities, pensions, and foundations have piled into private equity for decades, hoping to match the blockbuster returns of Yale's legendary endowment chief, David Swensen. But Swensen's approach is becoming harder and harder to copy, even at Yale. Swensen, who died from cancer in 2021, produced an annualized return of 13.1% during his 36-year run at the Ivy League school. Much of his gains came from alternatives to stocks and bonds. Big institutional investors have since followed Yale into these less liquid markets, particularly private equity. But in recent years, private equity has lagged behind the S&P 500, and much of what those funds earned for their investors in that time was on paper. Endowments and other institutions were getting less cash that they could put to work in the booming stock market. Higher interest rates have turned the private equity market on its head, crimping returns and making it hard for managers to get the prices they want for companies in their portfolios. Meanwhile, institutions have struggled to find investments that hedge against stocks and private equity without further eroding returns. And the problem's gotten worse with the stock market's latest rally. Swensen's private equity success was fueled in part by nearly 40 years of declining interest rates. The present-day stewards of endowments aren't so lucky. Just because something has worked for a particular set of institutions over some period of time, it's not a guarantee of future success, retired Yale private equity manager Tim Sullivan said on the investing podcast, Capital Allocators. Private equity returns for endowments and foundations have trailed stocks for 3 years in a row, according to Wilshire Trust Universe Comparison Service. 10-year annualized returns at many Ivy League schools last year fell to their lowest point since 2019, the first year that figure didn't include financial crisis losses. Several top schools, including Yale, are selling or contemplating selling private equity assets early at a discount, something Swenson never did. Yale said in a statement that it remains committed to its private market strategy. We trust that sophisticated investors, particularly our partners who know us best, understand this, the school said. Private equity holdings in the broader nonprofit world have been shrinking, with the average allocation at large universities and foundations at 46% as of June the 30th, down from 58% 2 years ago, according to Wilshire TUCS. Among Ivy League schools whose private equity portfolios often outperform the broader group, only a few universities have cut their allocations. When Swenson started in 1985, universities held mainly stocks and bonds, ignoring private equity, real estate, and other alternatives. But those dark corners, as Swenson described them in his 2000 book, were where he found rewarding investments. Swenson also had a knack for picking the right managers, and in the private markets, the gap in performance between the best and the also-rans was far wider than, say, the top stock or bond picker and the middling ones. Since then, private equity has grown from a dark corner into a $7 trillion market. Some of Swenson's other principles on diversification have also gotten harder to follow. The Yale Endowment chief said in a 2017 interview that one of his most important metrics was the share of the portfolio in cash, bonds, and hedge funds. While private equity often moves in the same direction as stocks, uncorrelated assets would protect the endowment in the event of a market crisis, Swenson said. Having about 30% of the portfolio in those assets, he said, helped Yale weather the 2008 crisis. As of last year, 5 of 10 elite universities analyzed by the journal, including Yale, held less than 30% in cash, bonds, and hedge funds. Yale's bond allocation fell from about 10% in 2020, Swenson's final year, to 4% in 2024. The journal reviewed the school's total assets in cases where their endowment's holdings weren't reported separately. People haven't been paying close attention to what Swenson was really saying, said Charles Scorina, a recruiter in university investment management. In the short run, adding uncorrelated assets would likely mean lower returns. Cash and bonds are no match for a high-flying stock market. What's more, fewer hedge funds offer investors much of a hedge against potential losses on the stock market. A 2023 Goldman Sachs analysis found an increasing share of these funds' holdings concentrated in 7 tech stocks. Conceding this reality, Yale in 2021 reclassified about $3 billion worth of its hedge fund holdings as equities. And that's private equity strategy of Yale is harder to copy. Our next article, Trump's Amass $5 Billion on Crypto, is by Angus Berwick. The Trump family notched as much as $5 billion in paper wealth on Monday after its flagship crypto venture opened trading of a new digital currency. The launch is akin to an initial public offering, which in the cryptocurrency called WLFI can now be bought and sold on the open market like a listed company's shares. Beforehand, people who'd privately bought WLFI from the Trump venture, World Liberty Financial, hadn't been able to exchange their tokens. The trading debut was most likely the biggest financial success for the president's family since the inauguration. The Trump family, including President Trump himself, holds just under a quarter of all WLFI tokens in existence. Trump's 3 sons are co-founders of World Liberty, while it names the president a co-founder emeritus. World Liberty says founders and team members' tokens remain locked, meaning they still can't sell them, but the trading launch now puts a real-world valuation on their holdings, which previously were valued based on private sales. WLFI is likely now the Trump's most valuable asset, exceeding their decades-old property portfolio. While the president's family has continued to pursue property deals around the world since taking office, the fast-moving crypto business has had the biggest early impact. Trump helped launch World Liberty a year ago while campaigning, saying it would help make America great again, this time with crypto. World Liberty's rise this year came as the president drove the growth of the crypto industry from the White House, reining in regulation and touting the potential of a private digital currencies to invigorate the U.S. economy. In advance of the WLFI trading debut, World Liberty this summer took over a publicly listed firm and raised $750 million in cash from investors to buy the cryptocurrency. That deal, an unusually circular transaction with the same party as buyer and seller, stands to earn the Trumps around $500 million since they keep up to three-quarters of the revenue from the sale of the tokens, the Wall Street Journal previously reported. Trading in WLFI exploded on crypto exchanges early Monday with about $1 billion in the tokens changing hands within an hour, according to data site CoinMarketCap. On Binance, the most popular exchange, WLFI started trading around 30 cents before slipping through the day to 20 cents in a similar range to prices implied by futures contracts tied to the cryptocurrency that traded there last week. At the higher price, the Trump stake is worth more than $6 billion. Adding in stakes in other crypto businesses makes the Trump family's overall crypto hoard even larger. Trump-related entities control around 80% of $Trump, a meme coin worth several billion dollars. A Trump-owned trust holds just over half of publicly listed Trump Media, which runs his Truth Social platform and buys and holds cryptocurrencies. That stake is worth around $2.5 billion. To be sure, cashing in this newly created wealth may prove difficult, as even a small amount of selling of cryptocurrencies can trigger prices to drop. Monday's prices of WLFI are a huge premium on the 1.5 cent that investors at first paid last year to buy the token from World Liberty itself, offering them an opportunity to make a big profit. World Liberty said those early buyers would be able to initially trade only a fifth of their holdings. Cryptocurrencies are notoriously volatile, meaning the exact size of the Trump fortune could fluctuate wildly. The $Trump meme coin launched in January initially soared and then collapsed. Critics of World Liberty say that it is a potential vehicle to influence the Trump family and that its growth is spurred by partners and investors who are seeking help from the White House. For instance, the market for a dollar-pegged stablecoin issued by World Liberty, called USD1, has been largely propped up by Binance, whose convicted founder has been seeking a presidential pardon, the journal previously reported. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said neither the president nor his family have ever engaged or will ever engage in conflicts of interest. Zach Witkoff, World Liberty's chief executive and son of presidential envoy Steve Witkoff, said last week that's strictly a private business and doesn't get involved in politics, though clearly President Trump is the greatest president of all time. World Liberty has said that its cryptocurrency's long-term value will be supported by its plans to become a serious industry player. In addition to issuing USD1, the venture plans to roll out a mobile app. "This isn't some meme coin," tweeted Donald Trump Jr. just after the launch. How much Trump-related entities control of meme coin $Trump? 80%. In that article, Trump's amass $5 billion on crypto. Our next article is from the Heard on the Street section of the Wall Street Journal. Taylor, tariffs can help sell diamonds. Swift's engagement levies on India could help bring back the allure of natural stones. Two consequential things happened for the diamond jewelry industry this past week. Taylor Swift got engaged, and America placed 50% tariffs on the country that exports most of those stones. Diamond jewelry retailers, Signet Jewelers and Brilliant Earth, saw their stock prices rise 3% and 26% respectively on Tuesday, the day Swift announced her engagement with football star Travis Kelce, posting a picture of her diamond ring. Their shares rose again by 6.3% and 2.5% on Wednesday when America's punishingly high tariffs on India took effect. India cuts and polishes most of the world's diamonds, while America is the largest consumer of diamond jewelry. Could it be that Swiftonomics is overshadowing bad tariff news? Possibly. Google searches for diamond ring surged after the announcement, but a tariff-induced boost in pricing might actually not be such a bad thing for the natural diamond industry if it helps differentiate them more from the ever-depreciating lab-grown variety by underscoring their value and scarcity. The tariffs on India could be affected by a federal appeals court ruling late Friday that struck down Liberation Day tariffs on trading partner countries. But the ruling allowed the tariffs to remain in place through mid-October to allow the parties to ask the Supreme Court to hear the case. Natural diamonds have been stuck in a bad cycle over the past few years. Margins on lab-grown diamond jewelry have been so high that retailers have been tempted to sell bigger, cheaper synthetic stones over the natural variety. This has eaten away at the market share and prestige of natural diamonds. Retailers' gross margins on lab-grown diamonds are around 71%, compared with around 33% for the real thing, according to diamond industry analyst Idan Golan. Tariffs might actually pressure retailers to stop presenting lab-grown diamonds to consumers as an interchangeable product with natural ones, according to Paul Zeminski, a diamond industry analyst. If you're in the natural business, you can't compete with lab-grown on price, he said in an email. One is a rare gemstone, the other is a manufactured product that can be produced in unlimited quantities. Plus, the sticker shock to consumers might be more muted than it looks because the tariff applies to the wholesale price rather than the retail price, according to Zeminski. So far, retail prices of natural diamonds are up 8 to 10% after the news of the 50% tariffs broke, compared with where they were when the threatened tariffs were only 10%, he noted. Tariffs also apply to lab-grown diamonds because India is one of the top producers of those as well. But wholesale prices on those are very low to begin with, and the cost of producing them keeps coming down, so the impact won't be that consequential. In fact, Zeminski notes that lab-grown diamond prices are down since the tariffs were announced. They might have declined even more without tariffs. Retailers can probably navigate budget-sensitive customers, too. Shoppers typically have a budget in mind when they shop for diamond jewelry, Golan noted. But diamonds come in such different sizes and quality, think color, clarity, and cut, that they can probably shift customers down to a size and quality that works for their budget, he added. Most jewelers now sell both the natural and man-made kind, which gives them flexibility. About a fifth of the diamond jewelry that Signet Jewelers sells is lab-grown, for example. Investors will get further details on the impact of tariffs when Signet reports earnings Tuesday. Signet's and Brilliant Earth's stocks have underperformed the market over the past 2 years on tepid jewelry sales. Signet's comparable store sales have declined over its past 3 fiscal years. The smaller Brilliant Earth saw weak sales growth in 2023, followed by a decline last year. Ultimately, demand for diamonds is psychological. The twin jolts of Swift's engagement and tariff-induced scarcity could be just what is needed to take the tarnish off natural diamonds in the minds of consumers. Investors are right to be celebrating. This article is by Jingju Li, Taylor, Tariffs Can Help Sell Diamonds. Our final item from Heard on the Street, Tracking the Market's Power Players. Think of a period when individual investors ruled markets and reaped riches doing it. the meme stock frenzy of 2021 might come to mind, but 2025 isn't far off. It's been difficult to deny the growing power of the so-called dumb money this year. Individual investors now account for about a fifth of the options market, according to J.P. Morgan. They brought back meme stocks, turbocharging shares like GoPro and Opendoor. They bought every dip, effectively propping up stocks through April's tariff turmoil. That's left plenty of Wall Street pros wondering what individual investors will do next and what that will mean for the market. The problem? It's difficult to say. Understanding everyday investors is a bit like trying to make sense of the U.S. economy. A survey here, a data set there, all assembled into a mosaic and filled in with anecdotal evidence, plus some gauges are limited in what they show. Take the weekly survey released by the American Association of Individual Investors. It's a popular measure of investor sentiment that asks respondents if they expect stock prices to rise or fall in the next 6 months. But the survey polls AAII members who voluntarily submit their response. Who are these folks? The average member is 70 years old with an average portfolio size of $4.8 million. Most are retired. These aren't the traders posting MicroStrategy memes or scooping up Krispy Kreme shares. That might explain why bearishness, as measured by the AAII survey, peaked the week of April 3 this year, the opening of the trade war, with 62% of respondents expecting stock prices to fall. Yet, individual investors poured $4.7 billion into the stock market at that time, according to J.P. Morgan analysts. That was a record until retail traders went on a $4.8 billion buying spree about a week later. Was that the more telling indicator? Maybe. But investors often mistakenly talk about flows within part of the market as if they are the market. Meanwhile, it can be difficult to distinguish the trades of individual investors from those of institutions. Whoa, and now the clock has told me that it's time to wrap up this week's edition of the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with this article by Hannah Aaron Lang, Tracking the Market's Power Players. You've been listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. I'd like to thank you for joining me for this Tuesday edition and remind you that you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming either as it streams or at a time of your choosing by going to sunsounds.org, the Sun Sounds of Arizona website, or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app from the Apple App Store for your iPhone or iPad, or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And, of course, you can always listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot or Echo.